Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. House Speaker Mike Johnson promises a house-wide crackdown on the virus of anti-Semitism spreading throughout college campuses as committee chairs announce investigations into the pro-Palestinian protests. House Republicans advance a bill that would write into law a new definition of anti-Semitism. A final vote will be later this week. But House Democrats are advocating for a different bill to increase funding for the Education Department and Justice Department's Office for Civil Rights. The Education Secretary Miguel Cardona is asked about the campus protests as he testifies before a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee. He also gets questions about the troubled Federal College Financial Aid Form known as FAFSA. House Democratic leaders say they will not allow a motion to vacate to try to remove Speaker Johnson to succeed, that if Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene brings it up, they will vote to table or kill it. The Democratic leaders write, at this moment, the time has come to turn the page on this chapter of pro-Putin Republican obstruction. The judge in Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial holds former president in contempt for violating a gag order 9 times with online posts attacking potential jurors and witnesses. The judge fines him $9,000 and warns that more violations could result in jail time. U.S. House debates removing the gray wolf from the Endangered Species Act. And dance and recording artist Twigs testifies before a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee about a proposed bill to protect her and others from generative artificial intelligence, copying and marketing their likenesses. Story from the New York Times: clashes over the war in Gaza continue to escalate at American universities on Tuesday as pro-Palestinian demonstrators stormed a building at Columbia in New York. Officials closed the Portland State University campus after students broke into its library, and police officers made new arrests on campuses in California and North Carolina. Even as tensions rose in some spots, with new encampments in New Orleans and South Florida, among others, there were signs that the disruption might be waning elsewhere. Police officers managed to end the 8-day occupation of an administration building at California State Polytechnic University, Humboldt, and encampments at Yale and the University of Pittsburgh appeared to have been vacated. That was from the New York Times. In Washington, D.C., House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, joined the chairs of several House committees to announce a new series of investigations.
Just last night, there at Columbia, students barricaded themselves inside one of the academic buildings. They fought with the maintenance crew there. They assaulted students. They broke through windows, destroyed property, hung in intifada banners from the building. And the law enforcement was nowhere to be found. We're told that NYPD is outside the perimeter of the campus, but they have not been invited in. And they won't go until they are invited. What are university officials waiting on? What do they need to see before they stand up to these terrorist sympathizers? And that is exactly what they are. What's worse, though, is that Columbia's choice to ignore the safety of their Jewish students and appease anti-Semites has inspired even more hate-filled protests to pop up across the country. And what we're seeing right now is people wave Hezbollah flags and Hamas flags, their homemade signs supporting what happened on October 7th. It's outrageous. Hamas endorsed the protest at Columbia University just about 2 hours before we walked out on the steps to have our press event on Wednesday. They're proudly chanting things like death to America and profanity and hate-filled slogans. And this is utterly despicable, and it cannot be accepted in this country. Anti-Semitism is a virus, and because the administration and woke university presidents aren't stepping in, we're seeing it spread. We have to act, and House Republicans will speak to this fateful moment with moral clarity. We really wish those in the White House would do the same. We will not allow anti-Semitism to thrive on campus, and we will hold these universities accountable for their failure to protect Jewish students on campus. And that's why today, we're here to announce a house-wide effort to crack down on anti-Semitism on college campuses. Nearly every committee here has a role to play in these efforts to stop the madness that has ensued. Joining me today are my colleagues in leadership, as well as committee chairs of the Committees of Appropriate Jurisdiction, and we're going to elaborate on what we'll be doing as part of this whole of the House effort. The federal government plays a critical role in higher education, and we will use all the tools available to us to address this scourge.
House Speaker Mike Johnson at a news conference today. C-SPAN did cover this entire press conference, and the video is available at our website, cspan.org. The chair of the House Education and Workforce Committee, Virginia Fox, Republican of North Carolina, announced that the leaders of Yale University, University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, and University of Michigan will be called to testify before her panel in May. The other committee chairs at the news conference were from science, space, and technology, energy and commerce, judiciary, ways and means, and oversight and accountability. On the House floor today, a vote to approve a resolution that sets up floor debate on a bill dealing with anti-Semitism on college campuses, along with six other bills concerning the Biden administration's policies on the use of federal lands. It was all wrapped into one. The vote was 209 to 205 along party lines. Again, debate and vote on the anti-Semitism bill will happen later this week. Congressman Mike Lawler, Republican of New York, spoke on the House floor in favor of the resolution.
What's happening on college campuses right now is horrifying. We've seen folks at these encampments telling Jews to go back to Poland as if they weren't kicked out of their homes, murdered in cold blood, and sent to death camps less than a century ago. The leader of the protest at Columbia called for death to Zionists. There was a sign at George Washington calling for a final solution, which was the name of Hitler's plan to exterminate Jews. People shouting that they are Hamas and calling for the burning of Tel Aviv to the ground. They chant for Intifada and from the river to the sea. These are not peaceful protests expressing their constitutional right to free speech. These are illegal encampments where demonstrators engage in harassment and where they urge violence against Jewish students, Jewish Americans, the U.S. government, the Israeli government, and more. I unequivocally condemn the college administrators that haven't acted to quell these encampments and who have enabled their campuses to become unsafe environments for Jewish students. At the federal level, we must give the Department of Education the tools to identify and prosecute any anti-Semitic hate crimes committed and hold college administrators accountable for refusing to address anti-Semitism on their campuses. This legislation defines anti-Semitism using the IRA working definition and its contemporary examples so that there can be no confusion or interpretation when it comes to the heinous act of discrimination and violation of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. It has broad bipartisan support in the House and the Senate, 59 co-sponsors in the House, including over a dozen Democrats. So, this is not about dividing Democrats. This has broad bipartisan support. If there are people in your conference that embrace anti-Semitism, that's not our fault. That's something you should be rooting out.
Congressman Mike Lawler, Republican from New York, on the House floor. It was during debate on the rules for debate on the bill that he mentioned, along with six other unrelated bills. And Politico writes that all schools that receive federal funds must comply with Title VI, but it has been unclear how to determine when free speech crosses into anti-Semitic discrimination. Congresswoman Teresa Leger Fernandez, Democrat from New Mexico, said that she did not support the anti-Semitism bill the Republican majority was planning to bring up. She supports an alternative.
We need to address anti-Semitism and look at the root causes. Instead, what are we doing? We're debating codifying a definition that numerous Jewish organizations, including Jewish Action, the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, and the New Israel Fund, among others, oppose. The reason these organizations oppose it is because we cannot equate criticism of Israeli policies with anti-Semitism. They are two very different things. And we need to remember that we are constitutionally bound to protect free speech, even and more importantly, when it is speech with which we do not agree. Yesterday, for example, in the Rules Hearing Committee for this bill, Representative Frey called Prime Minister Netanyahu's work in Gaza remarkable. He praised it. I personally don't think it's remarkable that over 35,000 people, and most of them children and women, are dead. I don't think it's remarkable that over 130 hostages are still not home. Netanyahu is being protested in his own country for these and many other things. I don't think it's remarkable that 27 kids have already died of malnutrition and that famine is imminent for 1.1 million Gazans. Saying none of this is anti-Semitic. I'm Catholic with Sephardi heritage, and I think that my love that comes from the teaching and my spirituality calls upon me to talk about these things, and that is not anti-Semitic. And that's the worry that these Jewish organizations, the ACLU and others, talk about today. If we really want to move forward on combating anti-Semitism, let's fund the office that investigates and takes actions against those colleges who fail to protect their students. Let's move forward with Congresswoman Manny's bipartisan bill, H.R. 7921, the Countering Anti-Semitism Act.
Congresswoman Teresa Leger Fernandez, Democrat from New Mexico, on the House floor before the procedural vote was approved to allow the bill on anti-Semitism brought forth by the Republican majority to come up later this week. On the Senate floor, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, talked about the campus protests.
Mr. President, I'd like to begin today by saying a few things about the protests at Columbia University. Smashing windows with hammers and taking over university buildings is not free speech. It is lawlessness. And those who did it should promptly face the consequences that are not merely a slap on the wrist. Free speech, discussion, and even strong disagreement are fundamental American values. And campuses should be places where those values are cherished. Campuses cannot be places of learning and argument and discussion when protests veer into criminality. And those who commit such acts are doing nothing to convince others that their cause is just. It is also unacceptable when Jewish students are targeted for being Jewish, when protests exhibit verbal abuse, systemic intimidation, or glorification of the murderous and hateful Hamas, or the violence of October 7th. As I said in my speech here on the floor last November, and many times since, that is anti-Semitism, it is loathful, it is unacceptable.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, today on the Senate floor in Washington. Columbia University released a statement concerning the overnight takeover of a campus building. It reads, in part, "We made it very clear yesterday that the work of the university cannot be endlessly interrupted by protesters who violate the rules. Continuing to do so will be met with clear consequences. Protesters have chosen to escalate to an untenable situation, vandalizing property, breaking doors and windows, and blockading entrances. And we are following through with the consequences we outlined yesterday. Students occupying the building face expulsion. This is about responding to the actions of the protesters, not their cause," part of the statement from Columbia University. The White House put out a statement. "President Biden respects the right to free expression, but protests must be peaceful and lawful. Forcibly taking over buildings is not peaceful. It is wrong." Education Secretary Miguel Cardona testified today before a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee about the department's proposed fiscal year 2025 budget, and was asked by Senator Shelley Moore Capito, Republican from West Virginia, about the campus protests.
Secretary Cardona, do you believe what is happening to Jewish students at Columbia and in other colleges and universities across this country is okay?
Absolutely not. I think what's happening on our campuses is abhorrent. Hate has no place on our campuses, and I'm very concerned with the reports of anti-Semitism. I've spoken to Jewish students who have feared going to class as a result of some of the harassment that they're facing on campuses. It's unacceptable, and we're committed as a Department of Education to adhering to Title VI enforcement. We have 137 open cases. We take this very seriously. We've increase the number of communications to college campuses to make sure that they have what they need in terms of the law and best practices on how to make sure they're protecting students. Look, as an educator, lifelong educator, protecting students is our number one responsibility. We take that seriously, and you know, the anti-Semitism that we've seen on campus is unacceptable.
Unacceptable. We agree. So you have 136 cases, you said. How long does a case take? I mean, by the time this goes through the system, quite frankly, it's either going to be all over or one way or the other.
Yeah.
To me, that's sort of an in. I mean, that's good.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're doing that. But you have more immediate means at your disposal. For instance, removing federal funds from institutions that get federal funds, which I imagine most all of them, well, they all do.
Right.
If they're in violation of Title VI.
You're absolutely right.
Are you intending to do that?
You're absolutely right. Investigating the cases is the enforcement part of it, but we do have on our website, ed.gov, there's a button there supporting campus safety with guidance and regulations around how to do that. And this is why in our budget we're proposing a $22 million increase to increase the number of investigators so we can move on those investigations that are open. And ultimately, if a school refuses to comply with Title VI, yes, we would remove federal dollars.
Well, I mean, a school can refuse. I mean, can go ahead and say they're going to abide by Title VI, but they're not doing anything. I would commend to you our former member of the Senate, who's now the president at the University of Florida. He is not taking a light touch here. I mean, he is saying, for many days we have patiently told protesters, many of whom are agitators or outsiders, that they were able to exercise their right to free speech and free assembly. We also told them that clearly prohibited activities would result in trespassing order from the university police. This is not complicated. The University of Florida is not a daycare, and we do not treat protesters like children. They know the rules, they break the rules, and they'll face the consequences. I mean, I would recommend this. Put this on the front of your page on best way to deal with anti-Semitism on campus.
We do have a statement that I've updated after the campus protests that make it very clear that being unsafe on campus is not going to be tolerated, and that we do not condone and we definitely reject any calls for genocide or any calls for anti-Semitism or any anti-Semitism on campus. And that's something that I've been pretty adamant about even before October 7th.
Do you have people at Columbia right now on the scene to see what's going on there? Do you have staff there to watch?
I do not have staff at
Columbia. Does the Civil Rights Office have somebody up there?
I do not have staff at the Columbia University. And I should share with you that we do have an open investigation at Columbia University.
Right. Okay.
Education Secretary Miguel Cardona questioned by Senator Shelley Moore Capito, Republican from West Virginia, at today's Appropriations Subcommittee hearing in Washington. The Jewish publication The Forward reports that student protesters at Brown University agreed Tuesday afternoon to dismantle their encampment in exchange for concessions from the administration, including the right to present their case for divestment from Israel at the next meeting of the board that oversees the university's investments. One student protester addressing about 80 students who gathered for a rally to announce the agreement called it a huge win. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is continuing his trip to the Middle East. Today he was in Jordan. Reuters writes that he said on Tuesday he would discuss with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu measures that Israel still needs to take to increase the flow of aid into Gaza during his planned talks in the country on Wednesday. Blinken spoke to reporters at a warehouse of the Jordan Hashemite Charity Organization, where aid shipments from U.S.-based charities are gathered. While there are some improvements in the humanitarian aid situation in the densely populated enclave, he said, much more needs to be done to ensure assistance reaches people in a sustained manner. That reporting from Reuters. Secretary Blinken also took a couple of questions from reporters.
Mr. Secretary, I'm Michael Gordon, Wall Street Journal. You said yesterday in Riyadh that the U.S. had not yet seen a humanitarian plan from Israel that gives you the confidence that civilians can be effectively protected if Israel is to proceed with a Rafah operation. Today, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said Israel has already begun evacuating civilians in Rafah, and that, quote, there would be an operation there soon. My question is, do you have a firm commitment from Israel that it will not proceed with a Rafah operation until they have presented the United States with an updated and detailed humanitarian plan that gives you such confidence? And do you have information from Israel or otherwise to believe a Rafah operation is imminent? And then the last point of clarification, the Israeli Prime Minister also said today that Israeli forces would enter Rafah with or without a deal, meaning if a ceasefire was arranged and it expired, they would come in after that. Does this decision to conduct an operation with or without a ceasefire deal complicate or even jeopardize your efforts to get a normalization agreement and to lay the groundwork for a Palestinian state? Does it complicate the effort to get a ceasefire? Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Look, our views on Rafah, I think, are very well known. The president's been very clear about it. I've been clear about it and repeated it as recently as yesterday. Where our focus is right now, along with the humanitarian effort, our focus right now is on getting a ceasefire and hostages home. That is the most urgent thing. And it's also, I think, what is achievable because the Israelis have put a strong proposal on the table. They've demonstrated that they're willing to compromise. And now it's on Hamas. And no more delays, no more excuses. The time to act is now. So our focus is on this, and we want to see in the coming days this agreement coming together, because again, that is the best way, the most effective way to really deal with the suffering of people and also to create an environment in which we can hopefully move forward to something that's really sustainable and that has lasting peace for the people who so desperately need it, and lasting security for Israelis as well.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken today in Jordan. He'll be in Israel tomorrow. A statement from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office reads, "The Prime Minister today met with representatives of hostages' families and bereaved families from the Heroism Forum and the Hope Forum. The Prime Minister listened to their call to continue achieving the goals of the war and to withstand the international pressure." And then there's a quote attributed to Prime Minister Netanyahu. "The idea that we will halt the war before achieving all of its goals is out of the question. We will enter Rafah and we will eliminate the Hamas battalions there with or without a deal in order to achieve the total victory." This is Washington Today. Back in Washington, D.C., from CBS News, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene threatened Tuesday to move ahead with a floor vote to remove House Speaker Mike Johnson, the same procedure used to oust Kevin McCarthy, after House Democratic leaders announced they'll vote to thwart any of those efforts. Greene, a far-right Republican from Georgia, has been threatening to begin a procedure to oust Johnson from the speakership. Greene this week said Johnson's days as speaker are numbered. In response, Greene posted on social media on Tuesday morning accusing Johnson and the Democrats of a slimy backroom deal. This is all from the CBS News article, and there's this paragraph. Greene faults Johnson for his work in securing foreign aid bills benefiting Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, and for working with Democrats earlier this year to secure a $1.2 trillion spending bill to avoid a government shutdown. House Speaker Mike Johnson was asked about this at a news conference.
House Democratic leadership just announced that they would vote to table a motion to vacate, effectively saving your job for you. What's your reaction to that?
First, I've heard of it. Look, I have to do my job. We have to do what we believe to be the right thing. What the country needs right now is a functioning Congress. They need a Congress that works well, works together, and does not hamper its own ability to solve these problems. And so we saw what happened with the motion to vacate the last time. Congress was closed for 3 weeks. No one can afford for that to happen. And you know, so we need people who are serious about the job here to continue to do that job and get it done. So, you know, I have to do what I believe is right every day and let the chips fall where they may. You've heard me say that many times.
Mr. Speaker, did you have any conversations with Leader Jeffries, either directly or through an emissary, before the National Security Supplemental came to the floor, about a possibility like this where you would receive Democratic support if a motion to vacate came up?
No. I was laser-focused on getting the supplemental done. Now, I've had colleagues from both parties come up to me on the floor, of course, and say, we won't stand for this. We're not going to shut the government down and all that, shut the House down. And, of course, I've acknowledged that. But I've not requested assistance from anyone. I've not focused on that at all. I've focused on getting the job done and getting the legislation
passed. So no deals were made of any kind?
No, there's no deals at all.
But, Mr. Speaker, would you be comfortable serving as, continuing to serve as Speaker by having the support of Democrats and effectively keeping your job because of Democratic support.
Listen, I am the Speaker of the House serves the whole body. I am a conservative Republican, a lifelong conservative Republican. That's what my philosophy is. That's what my record is. And we'll continue to govern on those principles. I mean, you know, you hope you have the support of everyone, the entire country. But, like I said, I've got to do my job and continue to keep my head down. This is a very serious time for the country. We're not playing games here. The world is on fire because of all the things that we've talked about today. We shouldn't be playing politics and engaging in the chaos that looks like, palace intrigue here. We need to be doing the job that the framers intended for Congress to play, and that's what I'm about. I'll continue to pursue that every day, and we'll keep the wheels of government functioning.
House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, at a news conference. The statement from the top three House Democrats, Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Whip Catherine Clark, and Caucus Chair Pete Aguilar, reads in part, "At this moment, upon completion of our national security work, the time has come to turn the page on this chapter of pro-Putin Republican obstruction. We will vote to table Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene's motion to vacate the chair. If she invokes the motion, it will not succeed." Congressman Aguilar explained more at his own news conference.
Congresswoman Greene is suggesting that she will move forward with this motion to vacate, citing the statement that you all put out. She claims that you are endorsing Speaker Johnson's speakership, that the Speaker cut a backroom deal with you all. And then she says, "I'm a big believer in recorded votes because putting Congress on record allows every American to see the truth and provides transparency to our vote." So how do you specifically respond?
Well, I'm not going to try to get in the head of Marjorie Taylor Greene. I don't know what goes on in there. It's her right to bring that up. The Republican rules that she voted for, that we voted against, allow any single member to bring this proposal up. She is a legislative arsonist, and she is holding the gas tank. And Kevin McCarthy allowed that to happen. That's not lost on anybody. What we are saying is we don't need to be a part of that. Let's turn the page. Let's focus on the issues that the American people care about. There's an FAA bill that was dropped. There's important work that we still have ahead. So I haven't read her full statement, but I'm not going to get into a back and forth on what she means.
Congressman Pete Aguilar, the House Democratic Caucus Chair, at a news conference, and part of that statement posted on X by Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, says that Mike Johnson is officially the Democrat Speaker of the House. What slimy backroom deal did Johnson make for the Democrat support? He should resign, switch parties, and continue voting for Biden's open border invasion of America, endless wars, full-term abortion on demand, trans agenda on children, warrantless spying on the American people, weaponizing government against President Trump and his supporters, and every other Democrat wish list item he's handed over. And Congresswoman Green and Congressman Thomas Massey, Republican from Kentucky, who co-sponsored the motion to vacate the Speaker's chair, say they will be holding a news conference on Wednesday, 9 a.m. Eastern. We'll have coverage on the C-SPAN networks. From NBC News, the judge presiding over Donald Trump's hush money case on Tuesday held the former president in criminal contempt over a series of posts on Truth Social that he said violated a gag order barring any attacks on jurors and witnesses, and warned Trump he could be jailed for further violations. Judge Juan Merchan ruled Trump in contempt for 9 violations of his gag order with a fine of $1,000 for each instance. Donald Trump spoke to reporters outside the courtroom.
Okay, thank you very much. This gag order is not only unique, it's totally unconstitutional. I'm the Republican candidate for President of the United States. I received this honor in record time. Nobody's ever gone faster. It's never happened. Nobody's ever got the numbers that we got. And I'm sitting in a courthouse all day long listening to this stuff. And everybody knows, as far as everybody is concerned, if you read the great legal scholars and experts, everybody said this is a trial that is nonsense. It should have never been brought. That's showing loud and clear. But you have a judge who's totally conflicted, totally, absolutely conflicted, that he's rushing this case through. I'll tell you what, somebody just told me they've never sat for such a long period of time in a courthouse before. It's ridiculous. I'm supposed to be in Georgia. I'm supposed to be in New Hampshire. I'm supposed to be in Ohio and lots of other places. and they have me sitting here for a Biden trial. It's a Biden trial.
Former President Donald Trump, the 2024 likely Republican presidential nominee, part of his statement outside the courthouse in New York City. At the end of the day, the trial in which he is accused of falsifying business records to cover a payoff to keep a story out of the news during the 2016 presidential election. CNN reporter Caitlin Collins posting on X this afternoon, with 30 minutes to go before the deadline, Trump has removed the social media post that Judge Merchan found violated the gag order. He had until 2:15 p.m. Eastern to do so. And prosecutors have laid out four other instances in which they said that Donald Trump violated the gag order. A hearing on those expected on Thursday. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi, it's Kayla from C-SPAN. Imagine 45 years ago when there was just a handful of television networks. C-SPAN first went on the air bringing an unfiltered view of government directly to America's living rooms. No spin, no commentary, just pure democracy in action.
And it's Greta from C-SPAN. It was a bold experiment. We finally had a front row seat to Congress, the White House, and the campaign trail, all without government funding.
As we celebrate 45 years and a legacy of unfiltered access, we ask for your support of a donation in honor of our four decades of service. Your gift, no matter how big or small, will help maintain this vital resource for access to the democratic process.
You can help ensure another 45 years of witnessing history unfold and empowering citizens to be informed and engaged in the political process. Visit cspan.org/donate today and join our 45th anniversary campaign.
Thank you for supporting C-SPAN, your unfiltered view of government. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make your gift of support. Thank you.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts and also on the C-SPAN Now mobile app, and that's free. U.S. Senate back in session to start the work on the Federal Aviation Administration reauthorization. $105 billion contains an increase in the number of air traffic controllers, also requires new technology to prevent airplane runway collisions, and prohibits airlines from charging extra for families to sit together. It triples the maximum fines for airlines that violate consumer laws. The bill does not raise the pilot retirement age from 65 to 67. That was in a version that passed the House, but not in the compromise reached between House and Senate negotiators. And from an Associated Press article, there's this: one of the most contentious issues in the bill turns out to be a provision that would allow an additional 10 flights per day longer than 1,250 miles to and from Reagan Washington National Airport, across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C. Delta Airlines and some Western lawmakers wanted to add 56 flights. The House said no, but a Senate committee approved 10 flights or five round trips, and that made it into the final bill. That was from Associated Press. Senator Mike Rounds, Republican, was interviewed today by Punchbowl News.
You know, when we talked about it a little bit in our conference, and the folks out west would love to have a few more contacts or another couple of the locations where they could actually fly into. We'll listen to both sides. I personally haven't made up my mind yet, so we'll listen to what they've got to say and then make a decision at that time. Maybe they'll find a compromise. I'm not sure. But most certainly it's an item that has been an item of topic, particularly because, you know, look, the bottom line is most folks, you all know, we leave every week, we go back home again, spend a couple days back in your home state, and then you're back out again. Reagan is a great location to leave from, and to be able to have access to in Reagan rather than Dulles to get back out into the western states, that's something I think that a lot of our members have really wanted to have.
Senator Mike Rounds, Republican from South Dakota, interviewed today by Punchbowl News. The FAA is operating under a temporary authorization extension that expires May 10th. The first procedural vote in the Senate on the compromise reauthorization package is Tuesday early evening, 60 votes needed to advance it. An article from NextStar Education Secretary Miguel Cardona said the Department of Education is working around the clock to make sure the FAFSA process improves. After major delays and a troubled rollout of the new financial aid form, lawmakers grilled Secretary Cardona during a hearing on Tuesday, just one day before May 1st, which in normal circumstances is considered college decision day for many high schools around the country. Many colleges and universities have been forced to push back their decision deadlines as some students still wait to hear back about financial aid officers. That article from NextStar. Secretary Cardona testified before a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee. Here are the questions from Senator Tammy Baldwin, Democrat from Wisconsin.
Secretary Cardona, like many of my colleagues, I am troubled by the ongoing FAFSA implementation issues, and I'm also deeply concerned that the number of our high school seniors who have fully completed their FAFSA is down nearly 30% from last year, and even lower among students in low-income schools. I know that your staff is working hard to fix this, but as I said earlier, the department has to get this right, and fast. Can you briefly describe what you and your staff are doing right now to get FAFSA back on track, including increasing completion rates this year so students don't lose access to financial aid?
Yes, thank you, Senator. I can assure you that this issue is something that I take very seriously, very personally, and I acknowledge the frustration and challenges that families and schools are facing. 30 years ago, when I was ready to make decisions about higher education, I never filled out the FAFSA. I was probably eligible, but it was such a big task that I was intimidated by it, and I didn't want to put that pressure on my family to go through that process. It felt too difficult. And for far too long in this country, too many students that have potential have missed out on federal aid dollars to chase their dreams. So I recognize the frustration and the challenge, but the problem that hasn't been touched in 40 years. The rollout of the Better FAFSA has been riddled with delays and challenges, and it's been something that we've prioritized at the Department of Education. We're doing everything every day to make it right. We are holding FAFSA clinics. We are providing daily communication to colleges. We have sent information out over a month ago to schools, and we are on daily calls with college presidents, financial aid directors, hundreds of webinars in different languages. We are visiting states and helping with clinics for families. We have if you visit ed.gov, and there's a spot right there where you can see resources for Better FAFSA. Just yesterday, I was on the call with national community-based organizations who've signed up to hold clinics to make sure that they're connecting the dots with schools. And we're providing day-to-day support to educators, parents, students, based on what we're hearing. We recognize the importance of this, and we're doing everything in our power to make sure we're providing more opportunities for students to fill out the Better FAFSA. At the end of the day, we're expecting the Better FAFSA can open the doors to an additional 600,000 students for higher education, and that's a huge difference for the potential of our country and the potential of our students.
Thank you for that answer. While we are still working on FAFSA this cycle, we know that next year is right around the corner, and students cannot bear another year of delays. So can you commit to an on-time launch for the 25-26 FAFSA by October 1st of this year? And will you commit that colleges will get all the data that they need from the FAFSA as soon as the FAFSA is launched?
Thank you. Yes, this is something that we've been focusing on while we're rolling out this year's FAFSA, thinking about next year's FAFSA. And I commit to make sure that we're moving all of our resources to make sure that we adhere to the timelines and do everything in our power to make sure not only that we're staying true to the timelines, but also communicating with parents, students, and schools.
Okay, so will you be able to reach the October 1st deadline?
That is our expectation, to reach the October 1st deadline.
Senator Tammy Baldwin, Democrat from Wisconsin, questioning Education Secretary Miguel Cardona at today's Appropriations Subcommittee hearing. Washington Post reports the Education Department said it has processed and transmitted 8.3 million financial aid forms to colleges, states, and scholarship organizations. It has also processed nearly 1 million corrections since making the function available in mid-April, some 4 months after the form went live. The U.S. House today took up a half dozen bills dealing with federal lands. One would require the removal of the gray wolf from the Endangered Species Act. Sponsor is Lauren Boebert, Republican from Colorado.
I, too, stand here today celebrating the success story of the Endangered Species Act, seeing that the gray wolf has been fully recovered. I also stand today, Mr. Speaker, in defense of our farmers and our ranchers, just like the Farrell family in Grand County, Colorado, who has lost up to five of their cattle in a 10-day span in Colorado from wolves attacking their ranch in Grand County. In my home state of Colorado, out-of-touch Denver and Boulder leftists voted to reintroduce gray wolves. Since then, 10 wolves were reintroduced in December, and eight have confirmed wolf livestock depredations and six separate incidents involving wolf attacks in Colorado just this month. My Trust the Science Act delists the gray wolf from the federal endangered species list and returns the issue of the wolf management to states and tribal wildlife agencies. Again, a success story that we should be celebrating here today.
Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, Republican from Colorado, on the House floor, rising to oppose the bill. Congressman Don Beyer, Democrat from Virginia.
Rather than celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act and the many species our nation's most successful conservation legislation has saved, House Republicans have relentlessly targeted the ESA and the wildlife it has protected. As co-chair of the Congressional Endangered Species Caucus, I'm deeply concerned about how House Republicans have proposed to weaken this popular bipartisan framework that preserves our nation's rich biodiversity. Today's scheme, a bill comically and ironically named Trust the Science Act, ignores what scientists are actually recommending to preserve the gray wolf iconic species and allow them to reach adequate recovery. The protections of the ESA have allowed gray wolf populations across the country to stabilize and regain strength. But if delisted nationally, gray wolves will once again be hunted and trapped to extinction. Some of the things that my friend has mentioned across the aisle, where they've been delisted in states, 90% of the wolves have been killed already. We've already seen proof of this in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. Trophy hunting of these beautiful wolves has recently been reintroduced in Wisconsin, with states such as Michigan and Minnesota ready to follow suit.
Congressman Don Beyer, Democrat from Virginia, on the House floor. President Biden put out a statement opposing this bill. The House has passed it narrowly, 209 to 205. Mostly party line, four Democrats voted yes, and four Republicans voted no. It now heads to the Senate. On Wall Street, the Dow down 570, NASDAQ down 325, S&P down 80. This story from the Washington Post, Attorney General Merrick Garland on Tuesday will recommend loosening restrictions on marijuana in what would be a historic shift in federal drug policy, according to multiple people familiar with the matter. The measure, if enacted, would not instantly legalize marijuana at the federal level, but could broaden access to the drug for medicinal use and boost cannabis industries in states where it is legal. Washington Post article also says the move may also prove to be a political win for President Biden, who is campaigning for re-election and has sought to ameliorate racial and criminal justice inequities wrought by the nation's long war on drugs. The Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Intellectual Property held a hearing today on the No Fakes Act. That stands for Nurture Originals, Foster Art, and Keep Entertainment Safe. It's described by the sponsor, Chris Coons, Democrat of Delaware, as a bipartisan proposal that would protect the voice and visual likeness of all individuals from unauthorized recreations from generative artificial intelligence, or AI. One of the witnesses was the dance and music and acting star out of Great Britain, known as Twigs.
I am not against AI. As a future-facing artist, new technologies are an exciting tool that can be used to express deeper emotions, create fantasy worlds, and touch the hearts of many people. In the past year, I have developed my own deepfake version of myself that is not only trained in my personality, but that can also use my exact tone of voice to speak many languages. These and similar emerging technologies are highly valuable tools. This, however, is all under my control, and I can grant or refuse consent in a way that is meaningful. What is not acceptable is when my art and my identity can simply be taken by a third party and exploited falsely for their own gain without my consent due to the absence of appropriate legislative control and restriction. History has shown us time again that in moments of great technological advancement, those in the arts have been the first to have their work exploited and in many instances fraudulently commoditized. Soon after, it follows that the general and more vulnerable public suffer the same types of image and voice-related exploitation. By protecting artists with legislation at such a momentous time in history, we are protecting a 5-year-old child in the future from having their voice, likeness, and identity taken and used as a commodity without prior consent. I stand before you today because you have it in your power to protect artists and their work from the dangers of exploitation and the theft inherent in this technology if it remains unchecked. I am here on behalf of all creators whose careers depend deeply on the ability to create safe in the knowledge that they can maintain tight control over their own art, image, voice, and identity. Our careers and our livelihoods are in jeopardy, and so potentially are the wider image-related rights of others in society. You have the power to change this and safeguard our future.
The artist Twiggs testifying before U.S. Senate Judiciary Subcommittee about a proposed bill to prohibit unauthorized digital replicas. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter word for word and get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.